Okay. All right. Welcome. Glad y'all came. Before we get started, just want to mention, if you have not gotten a raffle ticket, please raise your hand, let us know, because we are going to be giving away some stuff from the production of this app. And hopefully no feedback. But anyway, there we go. That's good. Glad you can make it. My name is John Lotshaw, and I'm kind of gotten volunteered to kick this thing off. Next to me is Bill Holbrook, the creator of Kevin and Kel, On the Fast Track, and Safe Havens. And then next to him is his lovely wife, Terry Holbrook, who is a professor of, what is it exactly, at Georgia
Literacy
State?
Literacy and Language Arts.
As well as a award-winning mystery novelist.
An award-nominated.
Not nominated. But in our hearts, she won.
Level, yeah. Yeah.
In our hearts, she won.
But Edgar, Agatha Awards, the ones that you've heard of.
So we're here to talk about the development and production of a interactive application for the iPad that we have been working on, had been working on for 2 years. And it is now available in the App Store for $2.99. So you can go and buy it, please. Go buy it. But we're going to tell you about what it is and why it's what's unique about it and how we put it together. So I guess we will just kick it off with Terry.
Okay. Yes.
Okay.
So we really started this as John said. I think it's actually over 2 years ago. Can y'all hear me? Is this up? No.
Are these on?
Is it on? Okay.
There we go.
I just need to talk closer. Okay. Closer. All right. We started off probably about 2.5 years ago with a challenge. We wanted to see what could three people do. How could three people come together to create an interactive story in an app format? So that was sort of the challenge that we set for ourselves. And in a second, we'll talk about the parameters that we put around that challenge. So, Bill, we want if you talk a little bit about yourself as the artist.
Basically, I'm Bill Holbrook. I do three webcomics. Actually, they're all on the web, but two are for newspapers. On the Fast Track, I've been doing since 1984 for King Features. It stars Dethany, the corporate goth. She's kind, hardworking, helpful, conscientious, and explodes every assumption her coworkers have about goths. Safe Havens is a fantasy strip. It has genetic transformations, time travelers, mermaids, and computers that actually start when you want them to boot up.
So it is a complete fabrication.
Yeah. And the last one is Kevin and Kel, and which this weekend celebrates its 20th anniversary as a webcomic. Began on the web on September 4th, 1995, and has outlasted every one of the webcomics that came before it, so that it makes it now the longest-running webcomic.
Okay, and I'm Terry, and I served as the writer on the team, and as John noted, I have authored four, what I call crime fiction or village noir novels that were published by Random House. And they were in this village noir style, which is they took place in small villages or small towns, but they had sort of this dark edge to them, or at least I thought they had this dark edge to them. And then I became interested in interactive storytelling and did some interactive poetry and some interactive nonfiction, but those are mainly event pieces that were sort of one-time performances that I did with that medium. And then about 2002, Bill and I had the idea that we should collaborate on a piece, because we had literally, our house was sort of divided into two levels. The art level was upstairs with Bill, and then the writer level was downstairs with me, and we decided to collaborate on an interactive piece that we called Fedora Street.
Yeah, it starred young female cartoonist who was solving a crime, and we created a website that was actually on the web in which a reader following in the book could, the characters talked about going to a website. You actually go to the website and see what the readers were looking at and get more information on what was going on in the story. Terry's editor for her literary works took it around to
her agent
took it around to various publishing houses, about 18 of them at the end, This none of them got it.
2002, I just want to point out.
None of them got it. In fact, the reaction in some cases was hostile to a online element.
Well, we found that a common response is, what's a blog? Because again, remember, this was 2002, and these were print editors and print publishers. So that idea of that you could tell a story that would be interactive and take place over two sites, in a novel form and on a website, I think was new. And I like to think we were just too soon. Yeah. We were too soon with that idea. But that idea of an interactive piece has been percolating with us for quite a while.
Mm-hmm. And then I got dragged into this because I was a webcomic artist publishing Bill's books. Actually, I didn't do this one, but his collections, which, by the way, there are free hardcover copies of these back there. Please feel free to grab one on your way out, courtesy of Bill and Terry here. But I was doing the layouts and publishing of Bill's books, and was also becoming interested in the new generation of devices that were coming out, particularly the iPad and its the other devices similar to it, and the possibilities that it held for comics, and what could be done with comics, that storytelling form and medium, how it could be blended with interactivity and things like that. So everything just kind of came together for this project. So
that starts, goes to the idea.
Right.
Around this time, this was around the summer of, I think, 2012, we really wanted to go back and develop some of the ideas that we had about interactive storytelling digitally. And at the time, I'd created a character in Fast Track named Dethany, who, she entered the strip in 2010, and something about her character just immediately clicked with the audience. Something happened that I'd never had happened before, is that people just kept writing to me and saying, I love Dethany. So I knew that I had something with this character. She's, again, bright, helpful, conscientious, and she's very much a techie and loves going into using her imagination in cyberspace. She has all these different avatars that she uses, and one of them was a film noir character. You can imagine her speaking in a film noir voice while she narrates some kind of tech issue that she's having to deal with. And because of the audience reaction that she was getting, we kind of decided to have that be the fulcrum in which we could develop this idea of interactivity in a story. And that's where the idea came from.
So like I said, we came together, but we sort of saw this as an exercise in kind of democratic authoring. We wanted to see what can three people do to create an interactive story using an app format. So we, thinking about this terms in this in terms of democratic authoring, we wanted to put some parameters on ourselves. And the first parameter would be, it would be the work of only three people. We had gone and looked at some other interactive stories, and when you get to the credits at the end, it looks like the Mad Max movie. I mean, there's just, you know, screens and screens and screens of credits. And our thinking was, if digital media are going to be the authoring formats of the 21st century, then it shouldn't take screens and screens and screens of people to create these stories. What would happen if we just took, not just, but if we took an artist, a writer, and a developer, what kind of story could we create? So that was the first parameter we put on ourselves, that it would be three people. We also added the help of Erin Pateso, who's my sister, to sort of be the project manager and keep us on track and keep our deadlines, because I don't know if I mentioned, but we're an artist and a writer and a developer. And, you know, deadlines, we
and,
love.
And to make it worse, the programmer is also an artist. So yeah.
That's right.
So it's double jeopardy there.
That's right, right, yes. So she came in. She was very, very helpful. But so that was our first parameter, was it had to be the work of three people. And the other one was it had to be self-funded, because, again, this idea of democratic authoring, it shouldn't take tens of thousands of dollars
or
to
more.
Be a, or more to be an author in the 21st century. So we didn't have a lot of money. We didn't want to spend a lot of money.
Yeah, because we didn't want a Kickstarter.
We didn't want to do a Kickstarter because we could have. But again, that gets away from this idea of, can it be done without a lot of money? Going forward, are digital authors going to always have to rely on Kickstarter campaigns or crowdsourcing? So we wanted to do this sort of experiment, see what could we do with just a self-funded project. And the other parameter we had was, of course, we weren't going to quit our day jobs because we all have day jobs. Bill, you know, hardest working man in cartoons and comic strips with his three strips. I work at Georgia State University. John is a cartoonist and a filmmaker. So we all had our day jobs. So this work had to fit around those. So we worked in the evenings, we worked on weekends. We fit that, we fit the work into it when we could. Again, with this idea of what can we do? Three people, limited budget, and working with the constraints that most authors work with.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so as you can see, we the cost came to about $3,000. That was in very kind of Bill and Terry to reimburse me for some of my time on this, but also in some of the tools, which I'll be getting into shortly.
And music rights.
That's right. We did have music rights and sound effects rights that we wanted to get clearances on because you notice musician was left off of that list. So, and we wanted a very specific style of music, so we went and bought buyout music. So we had to license those. The stories you can see, it takes about, there's about 200 screens, and each one of those has artwork. Many of them, well, almost everyone has some form of animation of some sort that was in there. And then, is that 18,000 words?
Yeah, that's Valtteri's words.
Which is about how much, if in a book format, about how many pages would that be? Roughly,
you're asking me to be a math person, and that wasn't.
And also, mathematician was not on that list
was not
either.
On the list, mathematician. It would be about this big.
Yeah, so it's like a good chunk of a
novella. That's what we call it.
A novella.
If I were calling it,
and
that's
what we call it, it's an interactive novella. And it took about, from when we first started talking about it, as you see, it took about 28 months, and a lot of that was intensive development time because every one of these was hand drawn. Mm-hmm. And colored by Bill, so that was kind of our bottleneck, and that sounds bad, but it's not. It's just because everything had to go through Bill because it was coming from. That was the whole point of doing this was Bill's art.
Well, the drawing. I started to do the drawing in April of 2013. I finished the drawing in May of 2014. So it was 13 months of really intensive weekends. That's what I was doing on weekends.
And while there's 200 screens, there's more drawings than that because we were doing them animation style on multiple layers. Mm-hmm. So some of these had six or seven individual layers that were individual drawings. Mm-hmm. So there's probably over 500 individual drawings that were composited together into this to make it. And then, as you can see, we are still friends. We still manage to talk to each other and use language that can be used in polite company and impolite company too. That is a difficult part of it is managing. You know, when you're working on a project, you have to say, okay, this is business. We have to put put the friendship aside. We got to do the business thing, then we can be friends again. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have any. Unfortunately, on this, there weren't any real knockdown dragouts. Mm-hmm. You know, we had our disagreements. We worked them out, and because we knew we were friends with that. That was something we wanted to keep going. If all else, we still wanted to remain friends. If we had to kill this to maintain the friendship, then we'd kill this. Mm-hmm. So,
Bill and I are also still married. I just want to make that point clear as well.
But you still talk to your sister.
Yeah. And we still talk to my sister. Thank you. She would appreciate that.
So, now we're going to talk about the. that's the first time I really saw that slide. And it's going to be that way, too. Yeah. Now we're going to each give you our viewpoints on the creative process because we each have. a different viewpoint because we were coming at it from different things. We had different responsibilities. Mm-hmm. So where we're going to start is with Terry, who was the coming from the viewpoint of a mystery writer, and that was what you did. So off you go.
So we'll start with giving you sort of a brief overview of the story, just sort of as an introduction. So click on the next slide. So by day, so the main character of the interactive novella is Dethany Dendrobia, and by day she's an employee at Fast Track, which is the business in Bill's strip on the Fast Track. go to the next one. But she's got her friend, a guy, who has an online game that he's developed called Virtue Noir. So it's this online environment. So by night, she takes on this avatar as a PI in Guy's game Virtue Noir. So in the context of the game, when she's playing her PI, as in any good film noir, an attractive member of the opposite gender comes knocking on her door with a small matter he wants investigated.
Identity theft.
Identity theft. But before she could really get into his investigation, she witnesses a murder. And then she has to solve that murder. And in the process of solving the murder, she has to make a series of decisions. But of course, this is an interactive story. So instead of Dethany making those decisions, the reader makes the decisions. And then based on the decisions the reader makes, the story unfolds in different ways. So if you want to go up. One more slide back. So the first decision point in the story is the murders happened, and she has a choice. She can either follow a clue that has been deposited, or she can follow the suspect. She sees someone that she thinks is a suspect. So that's the first decision point. So the reader first has to decide, do I follow the clue or do I follow the suspect?
You've probably noticed the artwork is all monochrome. Except when you see color, like with the flyer for the Cyber Cafe, that's when you know you have a decision point to make. Color is the decision, is the signal to the reader that, I have to make a decision here. Which path do I take?
And the paths are also color-coded, which I keep insisting that you see here. So you know where you are in the branch by the color coding of the tone that you're in.
You can probably see that in the next slide.
Which we've been constantly going to.
Because we like
purple, blue, and sepia.
Yeah. So the murder, the original murder takes place, and it's all coded. It's all in a purple tone. And then once the reader decides, do I follow the clue or do I follow the suspect, it takes the reader into two entirely separate parallel stories. One in which Dethany continues as the private investigator, and one in which she takes on the role of an action hero. Yes.
There are two different stories.
So, can you, yes, you can go through it and start it again. Yes.
Yeah. In fact, you can even there's points where you can actually jump from one story to the other.
Yeah.
And if I could just say,
Story chart slide.
We'll get to that in a moment.
We will
be having a question session afterwards. So please let us get through this one first.
We rehearse this.
But we will be happy to take all of your questions afterwards. So if you just hold them. Everything will be answered, and if not, we'll make something up.
That's true too.
Okay.
So you can see from here, once the reader chooses between the action hero story or the PI, then the color changes. The PI story is in sepia tones, and the action of story, the action hero story is in blue tones. All right, so we made a creative decision right at the beginning of this project that we wanted the story told equally in images and words. We had seen a lot of types of interactive stories where it was either almost entirely in images, as in interactive graphic novels, or entirely in words, as in hypertext novels, and we wanted something that would combine those two. So in this interactive novella, what you'll see, and the reader is coached to do this at the beginning, but if you come to an image and you see Dethany's either her tablet, her iPad, but her tablet, or her satchel, the reader clicks on it, and you want to just click on it. And it takes you to her tablet where she has been taking notes and writing. So the tablet always holds the written part of the story, and then the images, of course, are in the image. But the trick is, as the reader, you can't know the full story unless you both read the words and see the images, because the story plays mm-hmm. out in both those two modes.
Words and pictures.
Words and pictures. All right. And then one of the main challenges, of course, as you can imagine, that we had to confront was the narrative design. Because Bill and I are both sequential storytellers, Bill through his images and me through my words. So with Bill, it was, you know, you start on a panel and you move from one panel to the next. And in his comic strip with me, the reader either decides to turn the page or not turn the page. But that's about as interactive as the reader, the opportunity that the reader has. So we had to decide, how do we design this for interactivity?
You want to show them the flowchart?
No, that's going to be up to you. That's we're going to let you do the flowchart.
Okay.
And of course, we didn't want the linear design, which was just a click through. That didn't seem very interactive to us. And the other option that we tried at first was sort of this infinite branching, which, you know, you'd come to a decision point, you'd make a decision, and then from that decision you have other decisions, and from that decision you have other decisions, and it just kept going on and on and on. And like I said, we wanted to remain married and we wanted to remain friends. So that, I mean, we played with that.
Yeah, that infinite thing kind of tripped us up.
Yeah. Yeah. And how do you build suspense? I mean, it was fascinating, and I've seen some really good stories that do that. But given, again, our constraints, we kind of failed at that. But we tried it for quite a while and then realized that wasn't going to work. So what we ended up doing was this. Which I know you probably can't see the type on that, but it was sort of a dual limited branching where you would choose PI or hero story, and then you would have decision points along both of those storylines where you could make a choice as the reader. But once you made that choice, it would then return to the main trunk of that particular story. So if you were reading the hero story, you'd have the trunk and then the branch where you'd make a decision, then it converged back to the trunk, and then you come to another decision point and it would diverge back to the trunk. And that's how the two stories unfolded, but they each would come to separate conclusions. So you don't eventually come to the same conclusion at the end. They're two entirely different parallel stories. And this is the story chart. Did you want to talk a little bit about that? Or I can.
Well, this is the story chart that you follow in order not to get lost. You can see how the stories branch out. They have different places to get to from one place to the other. You can make different choices, but they all lead at the end to two different conclusions.
And this page is available from every page on mm-hmm. in the story by clicking on a tapping on where it says story chart, and it'll bring you to this, and it will only reveal as much as you have done in the story. So if you're if you're only up at the decision point up here at the very top where it branches off in the two, you're only going to see those three icons at the top because that's all that's been revealed to you. And it will not reveal story points that you have not seen. So no spoilers. Mm-hmm. And you can't jump ahead in the story using this because you do need to enforce some measure of linearity into it. Otherwise, it's not going to make any sense. Mm-hmm. You know, it'd be like, you know, watching Lost with the last episode.
Or just watching
Which
Lost.
Didn't make any sense anyway. Yeah. But it'd be jumping into a serial show in the middle of it. And what's going on? None of this makes any sense. We didn't want you to be able to jump over from, say, over here where this iPhone is, all the way down to the lower left-hand corner, because none of what you're experiencing there would make any sense, because you wouldn't know. There has to be some linearity to it. It can't be truly 100% random access, because we live in a linear world.
And it's a mystery.
And it is a mystery, but what's happening now is dependent upon things that had happened to the characters before, mm-hmm. so you needed to have that context. Mm-hmm. So we didn't want you to be able to, but we wanted to be able to, if you wanted to, and you've already hit that point in the story, be able to go back to it at any time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, because sometimes we know when you're reading, you want to go, oh, wait, let me go back. I want to read a little bit. You know, maybe I missed something. So we wanted you to be able to go back.
Exactly.
We didn't want you to be able to go forward. Mm-hmm. Okay, and just so my biggest challenge I found once we had decided on the structure was Dethany's voice, because I don't know, for those of y'all who read Bill's strip, Dethany has a very distinctive voice, and that's Bill's creation, but Bill channels Dethany in the comic strip. So the challenge for me became, in the interactive novella, what would Dethany's voice be if I'm writing her voice? And what we decided together was, you know, Dethany's fun. She enjoys playing. She enjoys the game. So that if she were in this environment of Virtue Noir, she would embrace the character. She would become sort of the hard-boiled PI. So her voice is very much how I would imagine Dethany seeing sort of Sam Spade or, you know, some sort of film noir detective.
Yeah.
Oh, and that was the slide I was going to speak over what I just said.
Okay, so that's it. Yeah. Okay. So that's her getting into the role playing.
Yeah.
Okay, now it gets to my challenges of making this into an illustration, which I had to make it work in two different mediums, the sequential art and the limited animation that we use. Because sequential art is my background. I think in terms of telling a story through a sequence of drawings. Animation is motion. And now we're using both at the same time. That was the first challenge. The next challenge for me was the screen image format. I'm used to dealing with four boxes in a strip, but I can alter the size of the box. I can narrower, wider, I can change the number of boxes in a strip. I can have just one box or six boxes. With this, the size of the image always was consistent. It's always the shape of the screen. So I didn't have that kind of freedom to signal story through the size of the panel. And as you probably know, that can be a significant difference. Same with not having any panel gutters. Many people say that the most interesting things in sequential art is what happens between the gutters. I didn't have that to fall back on. So this really was using muscles that I had never used before. And same with page placement. When you're designing, say, a comic book page, you have a big page like this, and the order of the panels can be rearranged, and maybe they're diagonals. Again, every image was a consistent size format, so I had to work within that. And also, it is all in monochrome. There's, except for the story decision points, there's no color. So I'm actually used to working with that in a newspaper strip, which is a monochromatic, but I do have the Sundays that are in color. So all those were challenges that I had to stretch my extra mental muscles in order to, I mean, this was a new terrain for me. Now, there were advantages in working like this, and the biggest one is literally biggest, because I could draw bigger. When I'm doing a comic strip, it's usually a panel, it's a little box like this. And now I'm drawing for the size of the screen. I can use more detail. I can focus in on things that I wouldn't be able to focus on otherwise. And that enabled me to have more world building. Like in this image of her in the city streets, she's not really in front of in a city street. She's at her computer, faced with all of the different shopping sites that you would find. She puts herself in the world of a computer as expressed through a film noir cityscape. And that world building was something I could do in a larger format. I was also able to create new characters. If you've read Fast Track, you'll know Dethany, of course. And in the introduction, you'll meet her boyfriend, Guy, who's developed the game that she's in. But everyone else is a new character that Guy has created in the context of this. And she actually meets new characters that she hadn't met before. There's Sam Hormel, Clive B. Dashing, Olga Krudgel. These are all suspects that you will be greeted with, and it was fun developing those. And the other image that I enjoyed working with was, as Terry said, you have to find the satchel in order to click on it and then get the text. So every drawing that I did, I had to say, where's the satchel? Where's the tablet? I mean, that, I had to literally start from that jumping off point and then decide how I wanted to present the image. So that was all, like I said, it was a 13-month process, but it really enabled me to stretch myself.
And just to jump in, because this really is going to talk about what I'm going to be talking about, but to get back to the democratic part of it, there would be many instances when Bill would deliver artwork to me and I would call up and say, this is great, mm-hmm. but if you did this, this, and this, mm-hmm. then we could, then let me show you what we could do for that. And the first, very first one was the murder.
Yeah.
That happens at the very beginning. This was the very yeah. first one, because you just basically mm-hmm. had him dead. Mm-hmm. I said, well, Bill, if you give me one where he's standing up, mm-hmm. and then you give me one where he's slumped over with the knife in his back, and then you give me the knife, I can have that knife come over, whack him, and he falls over. And we do it with the sound effects. I put a Wilhelm scream in there. Yes, the Wilhelm scream is in there. So and he said, oh, I don't know. I said, let me just show you. So if you just do it, and I promise you, it's gonna be so okay. So we did it, and then I did it and rendered it out in a QuickTime movie and sent it back. And then when they called me, they said, that was great. We got to do more of that. So there were many more instances where I would get in it and I would see how it would be broken up, mm-hmm. and then I'd call and say, "Well, if you could give me this, this, and this, mm-hmm. then we could do this." And then and that would just because what we needed to do was have as much of that kind of eye candy. Mm-hmm. It really is what it is. I mean, it doesn't. Add to the story, because what Bill gave me originally would illustrate it, but it's taking it out of that, adding that third dimension of time to it, that Bill normally doesn't have to work with, mm-hmm. and so having that was part of the democratic part of what you're talking mm-hmm. about. We were talking about Terry, where it truly became a collaborative effort. It wasn't just you do this part, you do that part, you do that part. It was a collaborative effort going back and forth, and one aspect of it would impact the other aspects mm-hmm. as well.
Right.
But I'm going to disagree with you on one thing. When you say that the animation didn't add anything to the story, one of the things that we
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
You can argue with me in just a second. Yeah. We really are still friends.
Yeah, we are. We are.
But one of the things we didn't want animation just for the sake of animation. Oh, look what you can do because you're dealing with animation. We wanted animation that would enhance the story, that would deepen the story. And John was really great about not just having sort of... I mean, I understand your term of eye candy,
yeah.
but it wasn't just so that we can say we had animation. It was animation that was designed in order to develop and enhance the
story. What I was trying to say is exactly what you're saying. There were images that were sufficient to get across the points in the story. The animation just took it to a whole nother level, and that mm-hmm. was the whole point. It was not animation for animation's sake, but it was animation mm-hmm. to enhance the experience.
Yeah.
And we don't have it on every page because we would mm-hmm. still be developing this thing if they did, but it was where it needed to be. We were very judicious about it and making sure that it was where we could get the most bang for our buck. So there's quite a bit of it at the beginning because we need to draw you into that world. There's ones at very important points in the story, and there's ones where some more static pages along the way, we'll have one to draw you back in to keep your interest up.
Right.
So it was. But what I was trying to get at was the democracy in action of one side. What their output was being enhanced by the needs and the suggestions of the others, and everybody saying that is that is where we need to take it. Mm-hmm. Let's go and doing it. So. Yeah.
And did you want to show the...
Yes.
Let me
go over here.
About the story development. This is the flow chart. And believe it or not, this isn't all the flow chart. There's another thing over here that just to give you this size of what we went through in developing it. Because as you see, it's in pencil, which means there were a lot of erasers. But this is how we develop the story, which each thing is a story beat, which involved a individual drawing. So that's what we, this is what I started out with when I started doing the drawing.
And then I got a script from Terry that I would work from, which had all the text and an artwork from Bill. And when it was printed out with artwork and text, it was about 125 pages of single space type laid out so that I would see where I was, and it also had my chart so I knew where my jump points and everything were. So there was a lot of material developed for this to even just to know where we were,
yeah,
much less how this thing was going to work.
Because like I said, this is a mystery, so it had to have clues, it had to have a progression. The thing about the mystery genre is that it has to run like clockwork. I mean, it has to be specifically intense.
Yeah.
Okay, so my part of it was doing the development. And the first thing that I had to do was try to develop, well, first off, how are we going to actually develop this? Because there are as many ways to program computers as there are computers. So what we had to first figure out was what was going to be the development tool set. How are we going to get this done? The first thing that we looked at was using native tools for the native app for these devices. That means on iOS, using Xcode and developing an Objective-C. And we have been thinking about doing an Android version of this. So that would mean something like Eclipse with Java. And I think I would rather have a root canal because I actually did do an app in Objective-C, and I would rather have a root canal. So that's also it would these are two completely different and incompatible languages. So that would meant duplicating our development efforts just to be on the two platforms. And so that as Terry said, we weren't going to quit our day jobs. I have other projects to do. I have other things to do. I want to have a life. So why am I a cartoonist? Anyway, so we wanted to do this in the most economical manner possible that we could develop. So that meant some kind of an abstracted tool set that would allow us to do the parallel development for the different platforms all at the same time from the same code base. And in looking around, the best option, there were several options, but some open source things that weren't really there. The one that was really the best for what we needed was a package called Corona. Corona is a system developed by a company called Ansca Mobile. They just got bought out by, I forgot who it was, bought them out. Fuse is just bought them out. And it's a development system for mobile devices. They're actually back then it was iOS and Android, but they've also added specifically for Kindle, specifically for the what was the one that Barnes & Noble, the Nook. they've got a couple of game platforms, and now they're actually going to be doing Windows and Mac OS X native apps out of this. So actually, it's not out of the realm of possibility in the future seeing this app on Mac OS X or Windows 10. And it's uses a scripting language, uses Lua as its scripting language, and then compiles to a native application, assuming that you have the memberships and everything in order to be able to do the certificates and everything. You can then take that code and put it on an iPad, put it on an iPhone, put it on an Android device, and it's a fully functional with in-app purchase and all the fun stuff that you want to have in an app. Now, when we started doing this, it cost $600 a year. It was an annual script subscription, but that was a cost of doing of business in this. That was the cost of being in the ball game, and a part of that $3,000 expense that we talked about. Now, here's the price of it now. They've actually made it available for free, completely for free. Now they make it free. Thanks a pant load, guys. But it's you can do all the development that you want. You can build all the apps you want for free because they're making their money off of enterprise versions of it. The advantages of it, as I said, the reason why we really wanted to go with this is, first off, it was multi-platform. We could do write once, compile many development. It was seamless. It really works. It really does do what it says. The graphics and sound capabilities were abstracted, meaning that I didn't have to call in a whole bunch of libraries and do a whole bunch of code just to make a sprite move from here to here. I could just say, sprite, move over there. It was a lot easier to code that, because that's one of the problems, I think, with the native tools is they are very verbose, and you got to care about libraries. You got to call them in. And then each one of them has their own syntax for calling them, and it's just nice to have one. It's like the old days on a. Well, not a Commodore 64, because you had to do this kind of crap on a 64, too. Because thanks, Jack Tramiel, for putting a bad BASIC on there. But anyway, the point is, it was like the old days in BASIC, where if you wanted to draw a circle, you just said circle, radius, and the center point. You had a circle. It was that simple. It supported in-app purchase, and this kind of came back to bite us a little later on, but Corona does support in-app purchase, so we could do a freemium model in theory, be able to put the app out for free and then lock off most of the application so that if you really wanted to go further, you could. And that's why we actually have this structure. We have this opening story that gets you into it, and then these other two branches, instead of immediately going to two branches, is that was originally going to be the free part of it. And then, as I said, it has an easy to understand language as opposed to Objective-C, which just makes my eyes water just thinking about Objective-C. And Java's the same way. Lua is much easier to read and much easier to follow, especially for someone who doesn't do this day in and day out. Now, I said easier to understand. Here is what Lua looks like. And so it's still code. It's still code. And I wasn't really relishing going through and doing all of this to program all the stuff that we had, because we've got some pretty complex animation in here. We've got all kinds of zooms. We've got a parallax scrolling. We've got all kinds. I wasn't really relishing that, especially looking back and seeing how long it took to develop this. I'm glad we didn't do this. So I was looking for some kind of code generation system, and I found it. It's called Qwic. And it's made by a company called Qwicture. It was kind of off the market for a while, but it's back. This is a Photoshop plugin that generates code, the Lua code, and the resources that I can then just drop into Corona for testing and compilation. Now, in theory, this would allow us to create all of our assets and animations inside of Photoshop, then pass them off to Corona, let it create the executables. However, a wise man once observed,
Yogi Berra.
This is the case, as we later found out. Let me show you what Corona looks like. Or Quick. This is Quick running running inside Photoshop. Now, if you look real closely, you can see it says Photoshop CS6, which is what? That's two levels behind or two versions behind. Okay, Photoshop is not a development environment, in case you didn't know that. Okay, if there's one thing you take away leaving here, Photoshop is not a development. There's no source control. There is no resource management. This is actually a Flash plugin that written in Flex. The reason why it's running in Photoshop CS6 is because Adobe deprecated Flex plugins in starting with Common Creative Cloud, and so it doesn't run in Creative Cloud. And we were also, on top of that, we were doing something with Quick that it was never designed to do, which is a novella-length digital story. It was not designed to do a Sam Spade novel. It was designed for Green Eggs and Ham.
Didn't they tell you that?
And we're about to get to that. It was designed to do, really, literally, it was designed to do children's digital pop-up books. And which would have maybe 40 pages, maybe 50 on the outside, and we have 200. Well, when we got to 128, this stopped working. Oh, crap. So I wrote the developer. I said, here's the problem. He said, well, send me the XML file. Squish, squish, squish.
Yeah.
Sorry, private joke. So he said, send me the source file, which was an XML file. So it was even more verbose than it should have been. So sent him this massive file, and he went through it, and he wrote me back saying, no one has ever done a project this big before with this. And I said, we're not even two-thirds of the way done with it yet. So we had to work. So we had to do a workaround. Basically, we had to split it up into two halves. You know, there was no source control in this. Code was being repeated over and over again. Because it was just being generated by the automated generator. There was no way to manage the resources in this. The resources, like for example, the tablet that when you tap on seeing Destiny's satchel and the tablet background comes up, you could make that a repeating element, so it didn't send out 200 tablets by putting a prefix on the name of the layer. That's how it knew that was supposed to be repeated. That's resource management in this. No, it's not. and if you forgot to do that, then you ended up repeating elements, so there were duplicate PNGs all through this thing. And then there were the restrictions on the size of the project. We found out that this thing really bombed out at 128 pages, and we had 200. So we had to split it, had to find a place to split it apart. Fortunately, because we had two storylines, I wonder how we could do that. So that was exactly what we did, was one storyline was in one file, the other one was in another, and the page numbering just was set so that it would start numbering at a certain level, and then I could just merge the files together by copying them into the same directory. And then there was the fact that it was Photoshop 6 only, due to Adobe changing everything and a new version of Quick coming out, so he wasn't going to rewrite this plugin. So I had to keep Photoshop 6 around just to be able to finish this project. But again, that's not that big of a deal, because you're working with any project. You never change application versions in the middle of a project. That's only asking for disaster. So all of that did not blow up in her face like my screen just did. And we finally got this thing done. And we got it to Apple. We went through a couple of iterations of getting it approved. If you're not familiar, Apple likes to control things, if you didn't know that. And there is the walled garden, the famous walled garden on iOS devices. So every app goes through an automated checking to see if there's any anything code-wise that throws up a red flag, and if it does, then it's handed off to a human being that evaluates it. And we had a couple of things that they didn't like having to do with the in-app purchase. Oh, the in-app purchase. I could go on about that. Suffice to say, it didn't work the way we wanted it to, and it was just because we having to do with multiple having to turn off pages and set them for this and set flags, making sure we didn't miss it. It just turned out to be a disaster. And in fact, when we first put it up, we did put it up free, and then people would buy it, and none of the in-app purchasing worked. Oops. So we said, okay, we're just going to pull the plug on the in-app purchasing. We push out a new version. Everybody that downloaded it got it for free. Especially the people who had paid for it got it for free. And then we just put up the paywall at the very beginning. So you just bought the app outright.
$2.99.
It's only $2.99. But Apple, the main thing about dealing with Apple was just waiting on them, because they have so many apps coming in, and they have to evaluate them and make sure that there's, if the automated system throws a flag, they've got to check it out. And then when you make a change and submit it, then you go back to the beginning of the line, to the end of the line, and you have to wait. But it was only a week turnaround, which isn't that bad. A week mm-hmm. to 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. I think we hit one after a major update to iOS, mm-hmm. and so that really delayed it, because everybody was trying to get their apps updated. Yeah. We've got it up to version 1.3 right now. And got it working pretty well, thank goodness. And so there it is. Please go buy it. Please, please. And so there we are.
So, questions.
Now questions.
Okay. Android version, yes. Can we
turn this down?
Okay. There we go. Okay. Android version, yes. We have talked about it. The only reason we haven't done it was because as that whole day job thing. I have not had time to actually go and do it. Because of the different screen sizes with Android, I'm going to have to go back and actually mask off and add a mask to all of the pages, because there are things that are sitting on the side. And I'm going to have to do this in order to do an iPhone version as well. Because there are things that are sitting on the sides waiting for their cue to animate on. So those have got to be masked off, because there are so many different screen sizes and aspect ratios in Android. It's just having to go back through and add the masking to everything. It is something we have talked about doing. We made the decision early on not to do it because, again, we had very limited resources, so we wanted to target the market for iOS, because we already had iOS, but also we looked at the business analytics of it, and Android users I'd say that they don't buy apps. They don't buy as many apps as the Apple people. People who have iOS devices tend to buy iOS devices because there is a rich third-party application environment. People who buy, by and large, who buy Android tablets, buy them because they're inexpensive or they were thrown in with their phone that they bought. So they're not in it to get the apps. That's not to say that there aren't. There's a significant number of people, and we want to make it available to them, but it was just the economics of it.
And we also need to get John a Samsung Galaxy.
Yeah, we need to get. Well, and that was another thing. Simulators only go so far, and you've got to run it on the hardware. And we just didn't have the hardware. We needed. It was taking long enough to get the iOS version. We had iPads. And was still taking 2 years to get it out, so it was just something. We just had to make the decision of we can come back to that, and we do intend to do that. I would love to, because
and we are
because I'm a capitalist and I want to make money.
Well, thank you.
And we'll get and you'll be next.
Okay. Oh, okay. Cool. Oh, microphone.
Talking to the box.
Okay. So I will actually be creating an app towards the end of the year. Mm-hmm. And
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
you have no idea.
Yeah,
well, now you do.
It was my first app. And I wanted to have a strong narrative behind it. And I like started like, you know, plotting things. I'm not a good writer. I'm thinking about getting my friend to help me. But I started to plot it in the same manner that you guys did the narrative sheet. And it was an absolute wreck. Arrows everywhere, lines, squares. It was horrible.
Well, if you look at this, it's a wreck.
Yeah, it looks organized though compared to mine.
It's an organized wreck.
And I also want to point out, this is the final version. There are lots of like, you know, balled up pieces of paper that got thrown across the room.
There's a reason this is all taped together.
Yeah.
It's because sections were removed and taped back in.
Hmm.
So, it sounds like you're in a normal part of the creative process.
Yeah. So my question is, how do I go about starting, and how do I take what I have narrative-wise and incorporate that into the actual design for the game, like the narrative design,
Well, it helps to get feedback to, if you're working with someone, get them to offer feedback, get it to someone you know, a friend you trust. Really, feedback is important at this early stage.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, and John offered this suggestion to us early on when we were struggling, is to think about it as storyboarding, and so that you're literally, you're storyboarding your story. And also, I would say, expect to mess up and be unhappy with things, and don't be afraid to chunk it and try something else.
We say there's two stories here. There's actually a third story that we started off doing, which has been completely round filed. So that happens.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. I know, Bill, you and Terry, I know, are obviously together and local. Mm-hmm. And how you collaborated with John, or are you local as well?
I'm local, too. I live about 30 miles from Bill and Terry. So if we needed to get together, and we did quite often, I could go over to their house. We met quite frequently at restaurants to have dinner and then go over the status and where we were, products, go over problems that we had. So we had quite a few meetings on this.
Macaroni Grill, a lot of business.
Yes, they did. They did. Lots of Alfredo sauce.
Yeah.
But
mention Mooney's Barbecue.
Mooney's Barbecue, great barbecue place in Flowery Branch, Texas style, by the way. So that also helped too. That we were always just a phone call away. And a lot of it was just on a phone call. When we say, hey, Bill, if we did this, could you give me this, and this, and change that, and then we could do something really cool. And then 2 days later, it'd show up in Dropbox.
Mm-hmm.
And that was another thing, collaborative tools online, things like Dropbox. That's how Bill got everything mm-hmm. to me. I didn't even mention about TestFlight, which was mm-hmm. the app distribution service for beta testing that has been purchased by Apple. But back then, it was available for Android as well. And now it's integrated into iOS. That enabled us to, once I had the certificate set up properly, could distribute to testers all over the country. We had people, mm-hmm. the friends of Terry's from academia, to look at it and test it, try it out on an unsuspecting audience to see how they reacted to it.
Some like Kevin Akella patrons were involved in that.
And some of the patrons, so we were able to incorporate that feedback into the development and of not only the code but also of the story as well.
This is a question for Terry. In a normal mystery novel, if you're ever writing, it's obviously linear, and even if you don't catch all of the little hints that you give, by the end of the story, it might not necessarily be laid out, but you can always be expected to get to the last page and go, okay, I'm finished with this now, and if I didn't want to, I didn't have to think about it. In this, as you were writing it, did you find that you had to be a little bit more explicit with your clues so that the player didn't necessarily get stuck or anything like that?
Yes, and I'll have to. This was an entirely different kind of drafting than I'm used to, because I'm literally, when I write my novels, I'm the kind of person that when somebody knocks on the door, I have no idea who's knocking on the door until I open the door, and so this I could not do this. It had to be much more outlined and detailed before we could send it to John, who would not have found it amusing if I did not know who was opening the door when I sent it to him. So then that was part of the reason we came up with the the idea of letting people go back. So as they're reading, because you can do that in a book, you're reading a mystery and you figure like, oh wait, I missed something, I missed a clue, let me go back. There wasn't a way originally for a reader to do that in the novella, so that's when we constructed that you can go back to these different points, so that as the reader of a mystery, if you feel like you've missed something, you've missed a clue, you can go back and reread that section again. So yes, it was a much more, I think, designed mystery than I'm used to writing. Did that sort of, is that what you were,
So I have a question for Bill. I don't need...
Bill doesn't need it.
I do not need microphones. I can project. But anyway, so one of the things I've noticed is that your art style is very different than your normal comic. Will Eisner?
Very much. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. The first thing I did was ask for...
Will Eisner.
When I moved to Atlanta... In 1981, I don't know if this is something old school people will remember, the Oxford Bookstore.
And, a moment of silence, please.
And on a Peachtree Battle, I was living in an apartment behind in the Peachtree Hills neighborhood. And every Saturday, I would go walk down to the Oxford Books and look at their comic section. At that time, Dennis Kitchen was reprinting the Spirit comics. And this was the summer that Raiders of the Lost Ark had come out, which was great. A modern take on old 40s adventure serials. And then I find the Spirit. Oh, great, another modern take on old 40s. Wait, this was made in the 1940s. I was stunned by this man. I had never heard of him before, and he's been a touchstone ever since. And of course all of his his sequential art books. The man's a god, frankly. When I started doing Virtue Noir, I just devoured all the old Spirit comic books, and making sure never to copy or actually do any swipes. I have that much integrity not to do that, but I wanted to get into that mindset. I never wanted to draw a roof the way he drew a roof, but my version of a roof in his world.
One shot that looked very much like a Jack Davis film.
Jack Davis, another,
When the girl was with Stephanie's running away from something, that's a Jack Davis.
Yeah, and of course,
Oh, Jack, the feet.
Yeah, Mad was my touchstone growing up, from 1967 moving forward. I was telling Jack Davis's son yesterday. They have a booth set up in the artist alley that I'm so indebted to him, especially drawing football players, because he has a huge shoulder pads, those really, really thin shins that support him. I can't help not draw a football player the way he draws a football player.
So I have to ask, out of all of the time that it took, if you had to do a sequel or another one, how much of it was getting used to the tools and the medium, and how long do you think it would take to recreate the experience?
Well, we didn't do this just as a one-off.
We didn't?
No, we did not.
Sean!
We took...
So much for that hope. Friends thing.
Yeah. Well, this was so much of a learning curve, and it's taken so much for all three of us to get to this point. It just seems a waste not to use it from this point, especially since we can do it without the learning curve now.
Yeah.
But we won't do it this...
Oh, we learned a lot of things on here. We learned not what to do. And in terms of the tools, the coding tools, those worked as well as could be expected considering what they were. I wouldn't do another project like this again. I would do another project like this, but not at this scale.
It won't be 200 screens.
We can't do that because the amount of effort that Bill had to put into it was just Herculean. And then I couldn't do anything until I had artwork from Bill. And so it was and then we started running into these constraints from on the size and where mm-hmm. it, because a friend of mine says it's not what a piece of software can do, it's what it can't do. Mm-hmm. And we found out what it can't do, because we boldly went where no one should have gone in with this software. But if you stay within those constraints, it works very well. And we did learn a lot of things, you know, ways not to do that, and also learned a lot about how to tell a story in this medium. I mean, that's the big thing. It's not so much what the tool about the tools is. We have learned a lot of lessons about how to tell a story in this medium, and because it is very different from what any of us were used to.
Do we have time for one more question?
One more question.
Can you talk just briefly about your marketing effort? Was that just osmosis and we're going to just put it out there and see what sells, or did you do specific things, and what were the results of your sales, if you don't mind sharing?
Well, we're just getting started, really. This mm-hmm. is, I mean, it's been out for several months, but this is part of our marketing initiative, getting the word out. So please, if you buy it and like it, post comments on the Apple site. Word of mouth is our best friend.
Well, we've been given the signal to wrap things up, so we want to thank you for coming. What I'd like to do now is quickly just draw. We have five. Yeah. Five. No, names.
Did everybody get a ticket, a raffle ticket?
That wanted one.
Okay.
One.
If you didn't, no. come and get one now while you can.
Yeah. There. Well, the tickets. Oh yes, I've got them here.
Yeah.
So.
Because what we are giving away is a original artwork.
Put the half in here.
Original artwork and a free copy of the game.
Yes.
Not the game, the app.
Sorry. Yeah, just tear it in half and put the other half in the hat. In the hat. In the fedora. Because we're going with a theme.
Either half.
Yeah, either half. They're both the same.
Okay. Okay, John, did you want to do the picking?
All right, okay. Here we go. All right.
And just if we call your name, if you'll just call your number, just wait and then come up afterwards. But raise your hand
okay.
So you know you're here.
243-692. 692. Okay, come down and get the keys to your new Buick. Okay. No. We'll just
wait.
Okay. Now 693. Wait a minute. Okay. 693. Okay. Let's mix these up a little better somehow. All right. Here we go. And we have 695. Okay. That's a little better. All right. If this is 696, I'm gonna. 691.
Really?
Okay. That census. Did you guys get together before? All right.
You can thank Staples.
Yeah, thanks Staples. All right. 683. Okay. Those are our five winners. 683. Great. All right.
So, but everyone is a winner when you come to our panel because there's enough for everyone to take one free book.
A hardcover Kevin and Kel collection.
Kevin and Kel book
all
back there.
On the back table. Please take one.
And if you want to play with the app a little bit, come to the Bill's table at the Artist Alley.
Table 32.
Table 32 in the Artist Alley.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Really appreciate it.
Yeah, come on up if you won the...